Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's January 27th, 16 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. So we are tracking a very interesting weather pattern for today. We have a massive storm system that's sitting off the West Coast, and it essentially is tapping into tons of moisture, bringing us what we call that atmospheric river, in basically a river in the sky, liquid fluid dynamics. It was bringing us some extra moisture into our forecast region. But the story with that would include the fact that we have a few pieces of energy, some troughs that are also forcing their way through the Intermountain West and through Summit Wasatch County. So you're going to see an increase in wind speeds and wind gusts. So that's going to be one of the bigger concerns for today, apart from any precip that's going to be a combination of some snow showers, a little bit of a mix, and snow showers. The reason you're seeing that, of course, would be due to temperature, but also because of that prevailing southerly. So even if you have colder air aloft, you might have a few pockets of some warmer air right at the surface that would allow for a changeover to some rain showers. For the most part, though, you are going to see scattered showers for today, snow showers, that is, through tonight and into early tomorrow morning. Now, then you're going to get a break and then more precip on your Friday into early Saturday morning. Let's get to your temperatures. For today, we're seeing mid to upper 20s, overnight lows in the 20s. But keep in mind, that's not really the issue as far as that overall temperature profile. It's the pocket of air you might encounter at the surface. Because, of course, we have that southerly flow, so just be mindful of that snow to mix to rain and that commute when you're driving today. And, of course, that added with the wind, that's going to be an issue. Temperatures for Thursday are going to be warmer. We're seeing mid to upper 30s, and then Thursday night, we're seeing mid-20s. The expected high temperature on Friday, we're seeing low to mid-30s and lows in the 20s, and then we start to see more sunshine breaking for the, I'd say, midday by Saturday into Sunday. A chance of some snow showers early Sunday, and then mostly sunny skies on Sunday, partly cloudy on Monday. The clouds are going to start to develop as the day progresses into your Tuesday, and then we're tracking another chance for some snow showers. So it looks like the two dry days are going to be, two and a half would be the second half of Saturday into Sunday and Monday. By Tuesday, we're already tracking the next system that's going to bring us some snow showers. I think for today, the windy weather and the change in precip, especially at the lower elevations and especially due to the lower wind profile, lower temperature profile, is something you all have to be mindful when you're driving.
Okay, Erica, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:08.
This KPCW weather report is brought to you in part by Deer Valley Resort, deervalley.com.
And with a look in the backcountry and the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, morning, Leslie. We have a considerable danger at the mid and upper elevations. You know, last weekend's good storm, desperately needed storm, came in with not a ton of wind with it, and with today's increasing winds, actually picked up in the wee hours early this morning. The winds have been from the southeast, the south, and the southwest. Even along the highest elevations, Leslie, they're gusting like 70, even 80 miles an hour. There's a lot of snow available for transport. I wouldn't be surprised to hear of some naturaling within the new wind slabs, but they'll certainly become more sensitive to backcountry travelers on steep wind-drifted slopes. Adding insult to injury, we do have a couple of buried weak layers, one that was buried with the storm that came in last Friday, and then also the old dragons in the basement. So any of these fresh wind drifts may step down into older, weaker layering. We do think that the danger will be on the rise during the course of today and then possibly into high danger tomorrow. As always, if you're leaving the Sierra today, at least you're heading into considerable avalanche danger. You may be stepping into high avalanche danger tomorrow. Stay tuned. We'll see how things pan out.
Okay, Drew, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up in just a minute, I'll be talking with State Representative Mike Kohler. Centerville Basin Planning Commission Chairman Ryan Dickey will be on the phone with us with details from last night's meeting. And finally, John Nine with Sundance Film Festival talking about all of the talks and events which are free and open to the public online at festival.sundance.org this year. Stay tuned. Wasatch County resident Mike Kohler serving his first term in the Utah House of Representatives, serving District 54, which represents Wasatch County, and as well as the Park City municipal boundaries. Representative Kohler joins me now on the phone with an update from the state capitol. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm assuming you're at the state capitol. Is that the case?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
So you're...
I'm trying to spend most of my days up here. They do have an option to join remotely, but it's difficult to participate fully, so I try to be up here.
Okay. So you wouldn't know otherwise, since this is your first term, but it's certainly not the same, given the pandemic. We've got mask wearing. We've got COVID testing. Are you taking a rapid test every day? It's certainly not mandatory.
We are requested to do it twice a week, so... Tuesdays and Thursdays are generally the days.
Okay, and so far so good with everyone?
So far we're good. I guess I'd be escorted out if I wasn't. So, yeah, they're leaving us alone.
Okay. Well, let's just jump to the big news of yesterday. Representative Andrew Stoddard launching an impeachment probe targeting Attorney General Sean Reyes and his ties to a GOP Attorneys General Association that encouraged people to apparently rally at the U.S. Capitol ahead of the January 6th riot and attempted insurrection. Can you get behind Representative Stoddard's request?
You know, I've heard it first on the news. Probably this is it. I need to look into it more. I would tell you now, I don't support impeaching Mr. Reyes. I would like to know more about his activities, but that's not something I'm going to support if it goes all the way. Certainly information can't hurt, and I'd like to know it myself.
Yeah. Representative Stoddard says it's not a partisan or political move, but in an attempt to find out what happened. So you do think that there's something that needs to be investigated?
I'm not really looking for something. If it's going to come out, let's learn about it. I think a lot of what happened at the Capitol is probably, my opinion is it's been partisanly discussed, and I think the more open discussion we can have, the better. Certainly we don't want to have that happen again. The causes need to be understood. And that said, again, at this point, I don't see Mr. Reyes having committed something that would cause me to vote for impeachment.
Yeah. So do you think this creates more division then between House Democrats and Republicans?
You know, in Utah, we're a little different than national, I would say. I mean, we try to keep cordial discussions with all of them. It depends on how far it's being pushed, but it certainly is an information gathering thing. I can't see the harm in it, as long as it doesn't interfere with business. That said, certainly the... It doesn't help if it goes far enough that people start getting really emotional about it.
Yeah, I guess what I had read that Representative Stoddard had said that the only other way to investigate something into this would have been through grandma requests. So are you aware of any other lines to investigate?
All I heard was what you heard on the news. I haven't talked to him or any of my colleagues about it. I just arrived here this morning and going to committee, so... I imagine it'll come out, or there'll be more discussion about it today. So I can't answer that because I don't know. I have to learn more about it.
All right. So what committees are you serving on?
I serve on the Social Services Appropriations Committee. We meet every morning. It's the largest budget of the committee assignments, and certainly something I've been a little bit aware of and involved in as a county official, but it's huge. It reaches almost everybody in the state when it comes to social services, help with mental health, et cetera. So it's been a big learning experience for me. And my standing committee assignments are political subdivision environment.
Okay, you're cutting out a little bit. So does that political subdivisions, does that have anything to do with the Boundaries Commission that'll be appointed?
For
the new congressional boundaries? You still with me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Yeah.
I couldn't. You cut out for a bit there. So I had said that the standing committee that you're on, the political subdivisions, does that have anything to do with the new congressional boundaries that are going to be redrawn, or the commission that's going to be set up to do that?
I didn't hear all your question. I guess I had a dead spot. I just walked to another park here. When it comes to that, I know that there's a commission has been set up. It comes back to the legislature for final discussion. We haven't had as a group, either as a whole or even as a party and a caucus, too much to discuss about it. There's been a few comments, but that's yet to be organized or even discussed heavily in any meeting I've been to.
All right. The legislature dealing with a $21 billion budget, and we're coming into the budget year with a huge surplus, and that during a pandemic. We've got more money than was expected, and I guess I've also heard at the same time this is going to be the year of the tax cut. The Utah Taxpayers Association says it wants to see the $80 million ongoing surplus to cut income tax and Social Security and military retirement benefits. Can you get behind that?
Yeah, I need to know more about it. Certainly the governor has put something, parts of that in his budget request as well and plan. Having not been part of this in the past, I don't know exactly the way it goes, but yeah, I can support a tax cut. It's great that the economy did better than expected during COVID, and there's still a lot of expenses to be put into that. So I think there's a lot to be learned yet, but if it's feasible and the funds are there, I would like to see a tax cut, yes.
And then some would also like to use part of the $1 billion one-time money to cut the personal and corporate income tax rate from 4.95% to 4.75%. But this is just for 1 year is what I'm reading. I mean, would that mean that you would raise taxes next year? No one likes to do that, so why not just leave it be?
I can't see it being changed for just 1 year, dropping it. Again, I'm new in the process. I'm learning more about it, but no discussions I've been in have gotten to that detail yet.
All right. Education every year, of course, we hear it is a big priority. In November, voters approved Amendment G, which allows lawmakers to use education funds to pay for programs that have been used in the past from the general fund for children and people with disability. So I guess what should school districts expect for this year? I mean, they were made whole after the budget was cut drastically last March. They came back, lawmakers came back in a special session. But for this coming school year, what should districts expect?
Again, it's too new for me to know. The Education Committee has had some discussion. I've talked to a few of their members. They're working towards what the governor has prescribed, and that is more money for education generally. Let's talk next week, and we should know more about the details of that. But at this point in time, other than what the governor's talked about and what the committee said there, what the governor wants, I'd leave it there until I have more information.
All right. Well, let's talk about just some of the other bills that are coming before the House. A House panel last week approved a bill that would allow Utahns to carry concealed weapons without a permit. And I believe it sailed through the House this week. So how did you vote on it?
I supported it. It went through last night, 54 to 19, pretty much party line, I would think. There's a few exceptions. As we went through the bill, I've supported similar shall we say, ideas in the past, and had a lot of calls in, many, many more for than against it, in my opinion, without getting too much detail. And you can obviously get into the weeds both directions. Training is important, and I think there was an amendment put in to have more suicide training and involvement with prevention. I think you'll probably see some more amendments to it before it actually finishes, but it did go from the House to the Senate last evening. So we'll see. Most of the people that I think this would affect are simply law abiders. They're not going out to do anything harm. The ones that aren't going to abide by the law are concealed carrying already. So maybe an equalizer, but it's obviously a statement bill that came out based on our state's general idea that the Second Amendment is important.
Did you happen to check with Wasatch County Sheriff's Department or the Heber City Police Department? Because I know here in Summit County, Park City and Summit County Sheriff's Department did not want to see that. They felt like their job is already dangerous.
Sorry, I missed you there. I actually talked to the Wasatch County Sheriff. He had some concerns about it. I have not had time to talk to the rest, but I fully intend to get with everyone. But like I said, we're going to follow it through, and I think you'll see maybe some amendments on training and whatnot, but I don't see that this is going to create a lot of harm.
Yeah.
Any harm, actually.
Well, people certainly opposed to it are saying, you know, guns are just as deadly as cars, and when, you know, we require somebody to go out and get a license, why wouldn't we require somebody to have a permit to carry a gun?
I don't disagree with that in some instances, but as I said, most people that obey the law are not going to be an issue. If they carry, most people won't. I do not carry myself at this point. I've had concealed, I took the class, I should say. I've never had the permit, but some of my family members do, and most of the time they don't, and I don't think this is going to make a drastic change.
The governor, before the session started, had put in, you know, a state of an emergency there at the Capitol, concerned about maybe protesters there at the Capitol. Have you seen any?
There was a few flags around on the first couple of days, but the involvement of the Highway Patrol as well as the National Guard was so heavy. I didn't really see, once I got in the building, it wasn't noticeable, so probably the real answer is no. It hasn't been that much, at least close enough where we could tell.
All right. There is also a bill apparently that would restrict voters to switch political parties. Do you know why that's being done, and how do you feel about it?
I don't. I just read the title of it. The only thing I would... I think there might be some concern of people switching parties for primaries, but I honestly haven't read the bill. I just saw the title.
Yeah, just because the Republicans closed their primaries, right?
And I think in this last section, because the Democrats didn't have really any votes for the primary, you saw a lot of switching to have an effect, and frankly, it had been the only way you had it involved in the governor's race. So I can't say I blame him, but I reserve judgment until I read the bill and see what it actually is trying to do.
All right. President Biden last week said he'll be considering the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante boundaries that were cut in 2017 by the previous administration. State leaders have said they do not support restoring those to the original monument sizes. How do you feel about this?
I haven't had a lot of experience down in that area, but theoretically, philosophically, I oppose the monument's expansion, but that's kind of, again, graded by the fact that I don't know the area well. I'm going by what I hear from representatives from that area. What I would support and what the state has done, both from the governor and from legislative leaders, is ask for a dialogue with federal people before they do it. I don't expect that's going to happen. I think you'll see President Biden just unilaterally do it. I hope that we can get into a conversation to make it reasonable and to get local people involved.
All right. And then another proposed bill would block government from having the authority to close churches or houses of worship during an emergency, like we saw, of course, last year with the pandemic. Certainly, that's great if people go to church together and live together, but these are the same people who go to our grocery stores and our post office and ski at our resorts, possibly putting others at risk. Is that something you would support, though?
I've again heard about this one, haven't read the bill. I'm going to reserve judgment until I do. I know there's a lot of discussion up here about emergency powers that the governor, the former governor, exercised in stopping business activity and churches. It's going to be a long conversation up here till I find a balance on that. I'll reserve that till I read the bill and actually see some of the activities. But in general, I think we've tried to catch, at least the state, in my opinion, has tried to, once they got the emotions and the fear out of it, tried to balance this with the science, and I expect that's what we should do.
Yeah, and I guess people are asking, why should churches be treated any differently than a movie theater? I mean, with internet and a smartphone, religious services can still go on.
I would agree.
All right, another minute here. Any bills that you're planning to bring to the session?
Well, I have a couple, some building code stuff, bills, related to agriculture buildings that and codes for those. Haven't got the bills finished. They should be out here in a couple of days. But nothing really. I said when I got in here that I do a lot of this based on defense, meaning I want to make sure that we maintain freedom, that we have local control, that we don't impose, unless it's really imperative, that we don't impose the state's will on local jurisdictions. And so that's kind of what I see my goal here and trying to obtain, and I'm watching it that way.
Okay. Representative Mike Kohler, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks.
Talk again. Thank you.
Well, complaints have appeared in the Snyderville Basin about two different types of accessory development. Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson talked to us about those two issues recently. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
As we have reported, County Council members Doug Clyde and Glenn Wright expressed concerns last week that a proliferation of accessory dwelling units are not fulfilling a need, as county officials hope. Chris Robinson noted that a bill proposed to the current legislature could relax oversight for the small dwelling units sized around 1,000 or 1,500 square feet.
You know, with no restriction, they just, instead of being a solution to our affordable housing crisis, they become just a nightly rental. And then the proposed bill is to take further restrictions off them, which is kind of going, you know, which could exacerbate the problem. The theory is if you have these accessory dwellings that the workforce could stay in, could rent for, you know, a reasonable amount of money and have, you know, long-term leases, you know, 6 months if it's work, or a year or whatever, as opposed to a week or a night, then that would alleviate some of the pressure. But the money, you know, the leases follow the money, and the nightly rental is more lucrative.
A different topic, you said, is accessory buildings for ranch or agricultural use. He said those are stirring concerns in neighborhoods like Old Ranch Road, where he lives.
The buildings that a lot of people complain about are the big barns or indoor arenas or other buildings that, you know, start out being some kind of an ag use, and then the next thing you know, they're housing something that may smack of a commercial use, or that a big percentage of the land is being encumbered by hard surfaces, you know, by these buildings. And that's a phenomenon that happens in Silver Creek and maybe in my neighborhood to some degree.
County Council Member Chris Robinson. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission last night on the phone with a recap, I have Chairman Ryan Dickey. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Leslie.
And the most interesting discussion, possibly the code changes there for accessory buildings and accessory dwellings. It sounds like we're talking about either a minor or a major accessory building here.
Yeah, I think we're looking at a few things. Both the number of buildings that would be allowed on a parcel, the footprint of accessory buildings relative to the primary structure. So, emphasizing that these are subordinate uses in the actual architecture and with a height restriction, and then the size and square footage. Actually, you know, limiting the amount of square footage that you would be able to have in accessory buildings.
All right. So can we kind of run through then the minor accessory buildings, which I understand would be allowed in all zones, and what the restrictions are for there? Again, you're talking about the percentage of the footprint of the principal building on the lot?
Yep, that's right. So this is a draft policy that we, that we really chewed through last night. But so in that draft, we're talking about a maximum square footage of 2,000 square feet for a minor building that would be allowed anywhere. And that's the minor accessory building. There's a second allowed building, which is, it's up to 500 square feet. That's something more like a shed. And then the major accessory building is allowed on a parcel of 1 acre or more, and it's a sliding scale based on how large the lot is. So the idea that larger lots can handle more intense accessory buildings. So it starts at 2,500 square feet for a major. That's for a 1 acre lot, and goes from there to, I think, an absolute maximum of 15,000 square feet for a lot of 5 acres or more.
All right. So these would need a conditional use permit in all zones as well. And both minor and major have height limits of 26 feet. So the Planning Commission seems to feel that this is a good start.
I think it was a good start. You know, you obviously you look at what's exactly the right number. I think, it's hard to really zero in on, is it 2,500? Is it 2,600? I think, Ray Milner, who does a great job in the planning department, put together this first start. And I think we felt like we largely have the concept right.
All right. still shipping containers apparently would be entirely prohibited. These are being used, though, I think, for affordable housing, no? So that would not be allowed?
Under the policy, there would be no shipping container or housing allowed. That's right. That's been a theme of public comment that's been pretty consistent over the last few years, that we're seeing too many shipping containers sort of I think we've heard that people feel like they are randomly or just strewn about lots, and folks really don't like the way that looks.
Okay. There would be apparently an exemption for an actual agricultural building. Some planning commissioners wondered, though, could this be a loophole? I mean, will we ever know if a barn is a barn or an indoor ice rink or 12 units of affordable housing?
It's a great question. I think that was comment that came from commissioners, is we need to really make sure that this is strengthened, the ag exemption is strengthened, that we're talking about actual ag exemptions. We don't want to see it turn into a loophole, for sure.
And another loophole, I think, was mentioned, if somebody were to combine a minor and major accessory building, could that be done?
Yeah, and that's not so much a loophole as just simply it would be allowed. Everybody gets that minor. Larger lots would get the major, and so a large lot could have a major and a minor. That's a total of two buildings, and that's something that came up. Is that something we want? And I think that's left in the policy for now. That was feedback we gave to the planning staff, and of course, then we're going to have a new policy that comes back for our next session and a public hearing. And excuse me, we'll get back into that.
All right. And then a discussion with regard to accessory residential units. There were three types proposed: accessory dwelling units, employee dwelling units, and live work units, and all allowed as low impact permits in different zones. So can you kind of run through the difference between them?
Yeah, sure. So the accessory dwelling unit, so the first one is just sort of that, what you imagine as the old garage or basement apartment or a detached coach house. This is, we're hoping to regulate well, but incentivize a second dwelling on an existing residential parcel. And that's what the goal of increasing our affordable housing stock by adding that density in where we already have residential infrastructure. We already have roads and sewer and hopefully transit. And we envision that these will all be quite affordable just based on what they are. And so we talked about governance around that in terms of size and number of bedrooms, things like that. The second is the employee dwelling unit. That is not allowed under the current code. All we actually have today is you can have an agricultural unit. So I think we have a lower demand for ranch hands than we once had. And so this allows any employee to live on a commercial parcel. So this is allowing us to add housing through our commercial zone, which is an opportunity. And just like number three, the live work unit, that's actually where the owner is sharing the same space as the commercial component. So I have a shop downstairs, and I have a residential little unit upstairs. And so we're conceptually here, we're adding housing that's affordable in the residential zones to the ADU, and we're finding ways to add housing in our commercial zones with the employee dwelling units and the live work.
So I think most importantly, how do we ensure that any of these are not going to be used for nightly rentals, Airbnb, things like that?
I think that is most importantly, that would be the worst possible outcome, is we've simply added a bunch of Airbnbs into our residential and commercial zones. And we talked a lot about enforcement, and I think today we I don't think there's any feeling that we have sufficient enforcement capacity to go out today and enforce a policy like this. We need to write enforcement into the code, and then we need to obviously then craft enforcement around it. Again, I don't think we have it today, but we chewed around the idea of, do you write code that's based on today's enforcement capacity and write code that you think isn't the best you can do, or do we try to perfect the code and then figure out, let's go out and enforce it once we have it? And I think we sort of landed in, let's write what we want, and then we think we can figure out enforcement when it's time.
Okay, so what's next with this then?
Well, next, this will come back as a revised policy at a future meeting probably 2 weeks or 4 weeks. I'm not sure, but it's going to come back quickly. We're going on a sort of fast and light model with these code changes to get them to council for their final review. And I think we'll have a public hearing at that next meeting, and we'll have a policy that's modified based on the feedback and a chance to move something along.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add from last night's meeting?
No, you know, we ran through a bunch of things, but I agree this general plan is the most significant thing. And when we do get to a public hearing, please, as the public, we really appreciate your input and hope you'll come to meetings and give your feedback.
Okay. Ryan Dickey is the chair of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Thanks for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you, Leslie.
Well, this year's Utah legislature may get into such hot-button issues as emergency health declarations and election reform. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that the Summit County Council is keeping an eye on the legislative session. That's part of their regular agenda today.
The council, meeting electronically, gets a legislative update at about 2 p.m. on Wednesday. The staff reports that given the controversy over the 2020 national election, a number of bills are expected proposing changes to Utah's voting system. County Manager Tom Fisher said they're aware of the debate over mail-in voting.
I certainly understand that there's differences of opinion on our elections. Of course, Utah has one of the longest histories in the nation on mail-in voting. I believe the Clerks Association is taking a very strong position that mail-in voting has worked in Utah, and are working with any bill sponsors around any type of election reform as they do each year. Sometimes these things with elections tend to take a little longer into the session, so we'll keep an eye on it as the Clerks Association keeps us up to date.
The report also said that following a year of COVID-related restrictions, they're expecting bills that might limit the ability of the state executive branch or health departments to clamp down on private or business activity. One specific bill would prohibit local health departments from issuing pandemic restrictions that prevent people from entering a church.
It would restrict emergency orders or health emergency orders from limiting access to a church facility. As we've gone through this past year with the different restrictions around the country, and then, of course, the way that Utah has handled that, it would be natural that we would see bills challenging the authorities in this. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of interest in these issues, both from the governor's office and the authorities of the governor to do these types of activities and emergencies, as well as at the local level. But we also know from legislative activity last year that the legislature has some opinions about that will be weighed into the mix.
On another topic, the Utah Association of Counties is pursuing some initiatives to help EMS services in rural areas, including possibly a bill for a benefits package to help recruit EMTs. Fisher noted that comes at a time when Eastern Summit County residents are trying to come up with a system to allow them greater control over emergency medical service.
I think the issues that we've been discussing in the east part of the county around EMS and around fire are not unique to our county. There are similar issues wherever we have volunteer fire systems and we need to provide EMS in an environment that we're seeing less volunteership and less ability for part-time EMS providers to make a living providing EMS, or they're working further from their homes, so it's difficult to cover shifts around EMS.
He added, another problem is it's often expensive for EMS to service widely dispersed or isolated regions. Finally, the report noted Summit County and UAC oppose a bill that limits a county's ability to regulate a billboard that changes to a digitized sign.
You know, we don't have a lot of outdoor advertising as it is. It does, as I remember, the bill allows some change out of physical signs to digital signs, and that would be out of the control of the local governments. Local governments are, especially the League of Cities and Towns and the Utah Association of Counties, are united behind control on this. But we also have to realize that there is a strong contingent in our state that lobby for this effort and lobby for deregulation on outdoor advertising.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, looking ahead to 2021, one of the tasks for the Eastside Planning Commission will likely be studying how they can address water quality problems in the Weber River. The topic came up at a recent joint session between the Eastside Planning Commission and the Summit County Council. During the meeting, County Councilmember Doug Clyde stressed, as he has before, the water quality in the Weber River is out of compliance with federal standards. Riparian areas of high groundwater around the Weber, especially in the Camas Valley, he said, are super critical. Later on, Councilmember Chris Robinson spoke to KPCW about Clyde's concerns.
The Camas Valley, let's say, is a very important aquifer that, you know, it's got those meadows that act as a recharge area for the Weber River. And so they have special value, and he's especially attuned to it because he does this kind of work, wetlands work. And so when you impose hard surfaces like pavement, concrete, and then you have contaminants like the little particles that wear off a tire or oil and gas leaks or whatever, then you run afoul of the wetlands or of this aquifer.
Robinson said that they have to find some mechanism to avoid development, although many longtime property owners see that property as their inheritance.
You know, the highest and best use for most of the land out there is ultimately going to be for development, unless there's an alternative like we've done in the basin, where we have, you know, BOSAC or COSAC, and where we've taxed ourselves and secured open space or bought conservation easements. We as a government have done little on the east side other than with ESAF, which has taken some impact fees paid by Promontory and put them in a little fund that has been used as a small match against applications by Summit Land or by Utah Open Lands or you know, something else to do a little preservation. We haven't had an active role over there, and so the landowners don't have an alternative, really.
At the meeting, Doug Clyde said that they have to act now, otherwise some years off in the future, Salt Lake Interest will sue them successfully for damaging the Wasatch Front's water supply. Even with entitlements, Clyde said the science shows the impacts of development in the Camas Valley.
You're going to find that your ability to put impervious surface in there without negatively impacting the environment severely is very, very small. And that's what current water science would tell us. To the extent that, you know, ultimately, I think what we're going to find is that those people's entitlements for what they have for their single family dwelling on, you know, 1 in 40 or 1 in 20 or whatever it happens to be, those will remain the same. But we're going to end up putting limits on impervious surface. We're going to end up putting performance criteria on their ability to filter their water. And the nitrates and the phosphorus has to come out, and we can't let that flow to the river because that's why we've got blue-green algae in the Weber.
That's Summit County Councilmember Doug Clyde. Well, the Sundance Film Festival isn't just about films, and the person responsible for the off-screen section is the Director of Strategic Initiatives and Senior Programmer, John Nine. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. So due to COVID, of course, we're doing things a bit different this year. How are things changing?
We are. You know, in some ways they're changing, and in some ways they're still the same. We have just a different engagement with the talks and conversation events that we always have at Sundance. So, you know, one of the things that's different is that all of the talks and events are going to be up online on the website. They're free and they're open to the public. All you have to do is create a festival account. So you go to the website and you can see anything, and there's a pretty broad range of conversations. Some that will be familiar to people, the old strands like Cinema Cafe and Power Story. And then we have a few new things that we're doing. I would say probably the one that stands out is we're doing a program called the Sundance Dailies. It's kind of a morning show that takes place every morning at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's a recap of what's happened the day before and look ahead to what's happening that day. And there's a bunch of fun segments on that. There's, you know, festival artists cooking breakfast. We have the Sparks brothers who are in the documentary, Ed Helms, Zoe Lister-Jones, just some really cool people. We have also, I think, a segment probably interesting to your listeners. We deployed former festival director and now roving reporter John Cooper to Park City to report on what's happening around town in lieu of the festival. He has a kind of interesting set of places that he's visiting. So yeah, that's we call that Sundance Dailies, and it's at 9 o'clock Park City time every morning. Kind of take a look at what's happening around town.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. What time zone are we talking about? Yeah. Okay, so nine o'clock
for your listeners, and then other panel programs throughout the day. The ones that people would recognize. We still have Cinema Cafe as we always have. That happens at 10:30 every morning. There are some really cool people as part of that this year. Amir Questlove Thompson, who people may know as one of the co-founders of The Roots, but he made a documentary this year called Summer of Soul. It's amazing. Rita Moreno is one of the guests of Cinema Cafe. Robin Wright and Rebecca Hall, who have both obviously know them as actors, but they have actually both directed their first feature films, and those are at Sundance this year. So it's a cool lineup of Cinema Cafe this year as well, too.
Okay, so in the past, much of this has been available to credentialed ticket holders, and you're saying that now this is open to everyone?
That's right. Yeah, it's open to everyone. I mean, I think, you know, and that really is in keeping with something that was important this year as we realized that there was going to be a different expression of the festival that included this online component. So both for the conversation events and also for the festival itself, the idea that people all around the country, and in fact, in the case of the Toxing events all around the world, all you need to do is sign up on the website. It just takes an email, and you can watch any of the programming, the public programming around panels and conversations. It's super easy, and anybody can watch them.
All right. And in the past, you have served as sort of the curator of the panels program. So as part of this, are we still doing these panels? Are they being done like on a Zoom platform or something like that so that you can get more?
Yeah, well, they're recorded. Most of them are going to appear on what we sort of like it's essentially a Zoom platform. Some of them are actually Zoom. Others are some of them are pre-recorded, some of them are live. It's kind of a mix of things. It depends on what they are. One of the things that, you know, has been true of talent as it appears in sort of virtual settings is it's sometimes a lot easier to get people because you're not really asking them to leave their house. And I think as a result this year, we got some really interesting people. If you look at some of the panels, for example, we have a fantastic power story panel, which is a group of Black women artists who are reflecting on storytelling forms around speculative fiction and historiography, Afrofuturism, you know, and then as part of that, we have filmmakers from all around the world. We have Hannah Beekler, who's Academy Award-winning production designer of Black Panther, Wanere Kahiu, who's in Nairobi, Kenya. So, you know, like one of the advantages of that is that you really can pull from people all around the world, and maybe in creating a more convenient way for them to come, we're just able to get some people that we might not normally be able to get.
Okay, so for people to be able to find this, I know you kind of got the thing, you've got like the talks and events under like the program schedule, you've kind of got the Festival Village also with lots of different dates that are shown specifically on some dates and then others that can just be accessed during the festival?
Yeah, that's right. And you've said it exactly. There's the official festival programming that you'll find on the website. That's under talks and events. And then also in the Festival Village area, those are all our partner organizations, allied organizations who are doing their own programming, often around films in the festival too. Most of those events they go up live at a certain moment in time. So there'll be events that appear Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And then they're available for the duration of the festival online. So it's a little bit of creating a live moment and then having it be available in an archive form for the duration of the festival. So it's a little bit both ways of watching. You can watch it live when it first goes online, and then you can come back to it later if you want to.
Okay, so people really just kind of go on, it's festival.sundance.org, get their account, and then just really kind of explore things, because there's like there's a lot going on.
And find there's a ton of stuff, and so that's exactly right. Get your account, browse around, see what makes sense, and there's some really pretty amazing conversations happening.
Okay, and we're going to find the John Cooper reports then in the Sundance Dailies, you said? Don't want to miss those.
Yeah, if you go under Talks and Events, go to Sundance Dailies, or just watch it every morning at 9 o'clock. You will find John Cooper each morning of the festival.
Okay. Hey, anything else you'd like to highlight before we let you go?
No, there are events happening throughout the day. We have some evening events that are more performance-oriented. We're calling them speakeasies. There's some great performers as part of those. So there's something happening at all points in the festival. I think the idea was to, try to mimic something that happens at the festival, which is people coming together. How do we come together when we're apart? And I think, I think we found some really interesting ways of doing that.
Okay. So where are you going to watch all of this from? L.A. or?
That's the advantage, right? We can all watch from the warmth of our house. I don't have to stand. I think of all of the people that I would see every single day lining up the street of Main Street for Filmmaker Lodge, the Elks Lodge, for Cinema Cafe, or for whatever. This year you can stay warm.
And people from California, I hear that a lot. So, yeah.
Exactly. I'm sure that all of us here in California are, although it's rainy and horrible. I will say that I, out of nostalgia, I brought up my Park City webcam for this, because normally I would be sitting across from you looking out that wonderful window you have. But so I felt a tinge of nostalgia, and I had to bring up my Park City webcam.
Okay, well, it's a whole different show now because we've expanded. So next year.
Okay, next year.
Okay, John Nine, thank you for your time this morning.
Leslie, thank you for having me.
Well, the Dakota Pacific development proposed for Kimball Junction returns to the Summit County Council agenda today. The Dakota Pacific project on the county's agenda for a two-hour block of time starting at 3:30 this afternoon. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher said the staff is not making a recommendation. They are asking the council, however, to discuss the proposal in seven different areas, including density and land use, affordable housing, transportation impact, sustainability, and phasing. The agenda says officially the project is up for a discussion and possible approval, but Fisher told us they're not really contemplating that the council will come to a decision today.
What we wanted to make sure is that with this agenda item that the council got a chance to see more or less a boilerplate development agreement that they could contemplate in relation to the current development agreement that exists. But also, we're really going to try and facilitate the council through a discussion of those 7 points, and if there are more, the council can bring those up so that we can really understand what it is the council is thinking about in those areas that the developer or the applicant can respond to. Because we're at that point where a discussion has to happen in order to see whether certain things will be honored within the development agreement or not for the council to contemplate.
The council likely will hear some comments from the applicant. We asked Fisher, what if that draws complaints, though, from the public that they didn't get a chance to respond?
I think certainly there will be open discussions along this, however long this discussion takes. And just because we've held a public hearing and closed that doesn't mean that the council can't open up for public comment again. And I think if things significantly change, we're going to, we as staff would probably encourage the council to do that.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher again, the City Council discussing that Dakota Pacific project at 3:30 this afternoon. Well, retiring after 20 years as director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, Scott Loomis says he's proud of their accomplishments in providing affordable housing, but the job has also been extremely challenging. KPCW's Rick Ruff has more.
Loomis told KPCW that at 72 years of age, he decided it was time to step down, and he's leaving behind a capable staff at Mountainlands, including new executive director Pat Matheson and managing director Steve Lawrence. Officially, his retirement occurs on April 30th, which by coincidence is exactly 20 years since he took on the job. He said that in 2001, there wasn't much activity in affordable housing.
There wasn't too much of it, and there wasn't too much going on at Mountainlands at that time. Mountainlands had just purchased, was in the process of finishing up the purchase and renovation of Holiday Village Apartments, but there wasn't very much in the pipeline at that point. So most of what's been done has been accomplished in the last 20 years, which I'm very proud of. And
Loomis said there were various reasons that more wasn't done for workforce housing.
You know, we had the energy and the wherewithal to do a lot more, but for various reasons, land being very expensive and unavailable, not entitled, some resistance we had at the top politically from various governments. We tried a lot. We had a lot of good ideas that kind of went nowhere because we couldn't get support for them.
He looked back on some opportunities that were missed or passed over.
In the early days, even before I started, there were some efforts that were really not well thought out. Or one good example is Bear Hollow. There was affordable housing with deed restrictions that just limited the price but didn't require income qualification or owner occupancy or any of the things that now the community is aware of.
Today, he said the governing councils in both Summit and Wasatch counties are supportive of affordable housing, but Loomis said it's always been challenging.
You know, years ago, there was a Utah Housing Coalition conference in Park City, and the keynote speaker topic was affordable housing. It's not rocket science. It's harder. And I think that's the thing that people have to understand is it is extremely challenging both to put a project together, to obtain the financing, to see it through. Many of the projects that we're now seeing, my involvement in those go back to the mid-2000s that are just now being built. We've got a very difficult process, and everything in Park City and Summit County is extremely time-consuming and expensive.
Scott Loomis, who said he will be involved with Mountainlands through the end of 2022, he said the group is busier than ever, even though their offices have been closed since last March. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.